It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. Coming up, a look at the surprising lives of birds and what they tell us about being human.
And speaking about birds, just over 8 years ago, a tweet was a bird sound, and a hashtag was most commonly referred to as a pound sign. Since then, the social media platform Twitter has radically changed the way we experience the world.
Oh, I remember those days, and it's Twitter's 8th birthday today, if you can believe that. And 8 years ago, few people probably would have believed that 140 characters would become such a powerful communication tool. We've asked social media expert Steve Knoll to walk us through Twitter's most significant moments and to compare just how different our media landscape is just 8 years after Twitter's birth. Welcome to Central Time, Steve.
Thanks for having me.
Well, 8 years is a reminder of how fast time goes. But take us back 8 years, if you would, because back then, you know, when Twitter was born, a lot of things were going on. Facebook was a lot younger. Flickr was sort of still something sort of trendy. What was it about Twitter at that moment in time, do you think, that really brought it to the level where it is today?
Well, it was really the ease of Twitter. The fact that it was limited to 140 characters meant that you really had to be precise and to the point and just sending out a really quick message. You couldn't just ramble on and ramble on. You had to have that quick, instant message that would go out there. And that was kind of a new way of looking at communications, especially in the last, you know, 20, 25 years with the rise of the Internet. People were used to being able to go online and having just tons and tons of information. So the idea of a micro, you know, communication was a radical and revolutionary new idea.
So, and at the time, and maybe this still goes on today, it seemed as though people pretty quickly divided themselves into sort of pro and anti-Twitter camps. I remember there were lots of people, particularly in my age bracket, who thought it was the silliest thing they'd ever heard. But the numbers speak for themselves 8 years down the road.
Oh, yeah. And that's the thing about Twitter is there is a bit of a learning curve to kind of get used to it. That's actually probably been one of the biggest things it's been criticized for is, you know, the idea of hashtags and the at symbol and, you know, the pound sign. And there is just a little bit of time that needs to be spent. So I think a lot of people, myself included, originally kind of looked at Twitter and saw, wow, this is just a lot of real insipid pop culture, you know, junk conversation, and never really gave it a second guess. But then if you kind of delve deeper into it, you realize that it's really an amazing tool. It is by far the fastest social media tool out there, and it is something that absolutely, especially for like breaking news and urgent news story, there's nothing else out there that can compare to the speed and power of Twitter.
And when you talk about that speed and power, you know, nothing says speed and power like a country trying to ban, you know, a Twitter feed like Turkey did the other day.
Oh, yeah. And again, we've seen this multiple times now. You know, a lot of people are still crediting with Twitter with the whole Arab Spring when the Egyptian government and other countries, you know, came down through all these massive protests. And I think that really shows that Twitter is really the social media of the people. It's really a tool that allows just common people to really have a voice and to very, very quickly get word out on the street as to what is going on. In fact, one of the very first things that brought Twitter into the mainstream actually came out of Egypt. It was actually an American student named James Buck, who was a photographer over there just shooting some protest stuff. And he was, you know, they stormed into his apartment and arrested him. And he had just enough time to get on his phone and get onto his Twitter account. And all he tweeted out was one word, arrested. And his followers were able to pick that up and then immediately call, you know, the U.S. consulate, who contacted the media, and he was released the next day. And so really, I mean, that was credited to Twitter and really brought its power into the mainstream. And that was way back in 2008, which seems like, you know, ancient history now.
And that power you talk about, do you feel as though it's plateauing? Do you feel as though there is still room for growth in the Twitter sphere?
Well, that really depends on who you talk to. Some of the experts are saying that Twitter has kind of tapped out its growth. I mean, hundreds of millions of people worldwide are using it. But certainly because it's not as user-friendly as something like Facebook, that there is a bit of a, you got to spend some time learning it. As a result, people are saying that maybe everyone that's going to use Twitter is probably already there. There is actually a rumor, a big rumor right now, that Twitter is talking about completely revamping its platform, trying to eliminate things like hashtags and retweets and the things that Twitter are basically known for in favor of an easier medium. I'm a little skeptical about that because that's kind of changing as to what Twitter is.
Yeah, I mean, this dates me, but that's got New Coke written all over it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's kind of funny because I completely understand that reference too.
So Twitter apparently is celebrating its birthday by letting a lot of their millions of followers, you know, go back in time, go back 8 years or whenever it was to find their first tweet.
Yeah, they created a website. It's discover.twitter.com.
All right.
And when you go to that website, you can just type in your username and it will search and display what the very first tweet ever was sent on that account. And when I was looking at that, what made me chuckle was once you look up your first tweet,
yeah,
it immediately gives you a button to retweet it.
So
I thought that was very meta, very, you know, everything comes full circle. And that's very Twitter. You know, it's they know what they are. They know they're a powerful tool, but they also they have a bit of a sense of humor. You know, it's kind of that geek humor that kind of permeates all this, you know, social media communication.
So what was your first tweet?
Well, I actually have multiple Twitter accounts, so
you're one of those.
So
okay.
Yeah, I do. I have a personal one. I have one for my teaching. So I did my teaching one was simply a message saying that our classes for our social media classes were now open and they're very popular, and we only had 4 seats left in enrollment. So, and that's been 4 years, and I'm glad to say that that's still true. We usually only have 4 seats left. My personal first tweet, I cannot say it on the radio.
Well, and I appreciate that. Yeah,
absolutely.
But, you know, you were talking about some of the tweets that sort of, I don't know, changed the world, but certainly changed history and changed things. What other significant tweets are out there that people might be familiar with or might not be familiar with?
Well, one of the bigger ones was actually not a tweet itself, but a picture that was spread. And that was when the airplane came down in the Hudson River, the Miracle on the Hudson. And, you know, someone walking by was able to snap a picture of the passengers, you know, deplaning with the plane in the water, and they're all standing on the wing. And that picture just, you know, spread around the world in, you know, a matter of an hour, which was just amazing how fast people were looking at this picture, knowing that this had happened, you know, 2 minutes ago. And it was just someone on the street. You know, we're used to, like, live television and radio broadcasts, but that's something where, you know, it's set up in advance, that they've got the equipment there. The fact that just the average person on the street now can become a global photojournalist in a matter of minutes was just kind of radical and kind of exciting in a somewhat terrifying way. Obviously, you know, when the raid on Osama bin Laden's compound happened, and we later found out that a neighbor of his was live tweeting, you know, that there's a helicopter floating over the sky, and, you know, in hindsight, finding out what it actually was, that really brought, you know, a lot of people into the, wow, you just even anyone can be on Twitter. Anyone can become a global, you know, tweeter, and just depending on being at the right place at the right time.
Well, Twitter is definitely part of the lexicon now. Is there anything else on the horizon that you think might wind up being, you know, Twitter-like and that it has this big impact? Or is it just too many things happening out there that it's hard to figure that out?
Well, one of the things that I've been looking at, especially in my classes, I've been talking about not necessarily the actual tool, but why people use things like Twitter. Twitter as a business and as an app may not necessarily be around forever, but I think the philosophical approach to these micro communications and this, you know, message of the people, I think that is an incredible new concept that's not going to change. I think people have now gotten a taste of what that is, and even if it's not Twitter, even if it's something else that has yet to be invented, just the notion that the individual voice can be spread throughout the land in a matter of minutes, that's a concept that is just not going to go anywhere.
Well, Steve, thanks so much for joining us. We'll look forward to your tweets about this little segment.
Oh, great. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
That was Steve Noel, business and social media professor at Madison College. Spring started yesterday, allegedly, even though the weather doesn't seem to be playing along. And as it turns out, Wisconsin is a big birding state, and a lot of people are getting the urge to head outside.
Our next guest is a serious birder. He's observed well over 2,000 species of birds around the globe, from Brooklyn to the outback and the Amazon to Antarctica.
He says birds are more intelligent and more fascinating than we often give them credit for. And he says by studying their behavior, we can learn more about what it means to be human.
Noah Stricker joins us now. He's associate editor for Birding Magazine and the author of The Thing with Feathers, The Surprising Lives of Birds and What They Reveal About Being Human. Noah, welcome to the show.
Hi, guys. It's great to be here.
Well, for a lot of amateurs like myself, even though I grew up in a birding family, the cool thing is sort of looking at a bird and going, that's a robin. Or maybe if you're a little more advanced, that's a scarlet tanager. Well, you've gone beyond that and you're looking deeply at bird behaviors. What's appealing to you about looking at the way birds behave?
Yeah, well, so I've been lucky enough so far in my career to spend some time in very remote places all around the world doing research projects with birds, places like Antarctica and the Amazon and Ecuador and the Australian outback. But increasingly, wherever I go, I'm fascinated not just by the mere fact that birds exist in a field guide to be checked off on a list, but in all the interesting things that birds do. And you can sit down almost anywhere in the world and pick any bird and watch it, and pretty soon it'll start doing something interesting. And that means you can observe interesting bird behavior right in your backyard.
And it's interesting that you're talking about looking at birds and how they teach us about what it means to be human, because typically when we look at what it means to be human, we look at the great apes. We think they're the animals that we have the most in common with. Why do humans have anything at all in common with birds?
Well, if you start thinking about it, birds and people, we need the same basic things, you know, food, water, shelter, a family, maybe like the desire to leave a legacy. And so it's been interesting in writing this book and studying birds in different places. The more I spend time with birds, the more I just find myself comparing them to humans. And I think that's been a trend in the past couple of decades in science, is that, you know, historically we were so focused on what differentiates people and humans from other animals and makes us unique. And that's flipped around recently. And now we're starting to see, okay, well, maybe we're more similar to other animals, including birds, in the rest of the world than we often thought.
One of the birds you start with is a bird that we take for granted, or at best we probably think of them as a nuisance, pigeons. Now, they seem like they're everywhere, especially where there's garbage or something like that. But you found a lot to be interested in when it comes to pigeons. What is it about the pigeon that strikes you as so interesting?
Well, I think pigeons are fascinating. You know, as bird watchers, we are trained not to pay attention to pigeons because they're trash birds and they don't get much respect. But pigeons are everywhere, especially in cities around people. And I think they can teach us some interesting things. You know, homing pigeons are exceptionally good at finding their way home from distant locations. You can put a racing pigeon in a box, take it a couple hundred miles from home, and release it with no point of reference. And somehow, magically, they make it back home. And, you know, that's one thing that if we as humans had as an ability, we'd probably be inordinately proud of. So I think maybe most of all, pigeons can teach us a lesson in humility, because they're capable of things we could never even dream of.
I had no idea until I read your book that there was such a thing as a racing pigeon. Can you tell us a little bit about that subculture and what people do with these pigeons?
Yeah, so racing pigeons go way back to the times of emperors and kings, when people had to send messages across long distances, and they would train pigeons to carry messages attached to their legs and use this magical ability of pigeons to find their way home. And so they would even be used in wars and flown across enemy lines. There were whole squadrons of carrier pigeons used in World War I and even in World War II when radio was coming out, because there were certain situations which required radio silence. Since World War II, the whole sport of pigeon racing has mostly gone to hobbyists, but there's still a lot of people around the world who raise pigeons and train them to fly home to their home loft and then compete against other pigeon owners to see whose pigeons can fly home the fastest.
Wow. So how fast does a pigeon fly? I mean, they're not exactly speed birds, right?
they're not the speediest birds in the world. I'd say a pigeon can probably cruise along at about, 30 miles an hour or so.
It's respectable. It's faster than people, I imagine.
Yeah.
Well, there was one story about a pigeon that I wanted you to tell. You mentioned pigeons being used in wartime, and there was a pigeon that saved something like 200-plus lives in, I think, World War One.
Yeah, this pigeon, I forget its name, it was called Cherami or something like that, and it was carrying a message that was very important to this military operation, and it flew in enemy territory and was shot, and one eye was blown out and its leg was shattered, but it still managed to make it and deliver its message and save something like dozens of soldiers' lives. And so it was actually given a war cross, and I think it's maybe the only bird ever to get a serious military medal.
That's amazing. And then they stuffed the bird and put it in the Smithsonian.
That's right. It's in the Smithsonian now.
I don't know if that's a fitting end or not.
Well, I think so. I think that's a place of distinguished honor for a pigeon.
Definitely a place of history, so I guess there's that. Something else I want to talk about, moving on to a different bird, snowy owls. Now, Wisconsin has been at the leading edge of snowy owl eruptions in the last couple of years, the idea being that they leave the Arctic, their natural feeding grounds, habitat, and come south. And usually we think it's because of food shortages. What are we learning now about snowy owls and that behavior of the moving south and wandering?
Well, this winter has been an awesome winter for snowy owls in much of the U.S., especially the central and the eastern parts. And every few years, for some reason, snowy owls, which live in the high Arctic, show up in the dead of winter far south of their usual range, even as far south as sometimes places like Texas. And for years and years, the standard explanation for why these eruptions occurred was food shortages. Snowy owls are known to mostly eat lemmings in the Arctic, and people thought that, well, maybe that was a really bad summer for lemmings, and so that owls didn't have any food to eat, and so they would have to fly farther south to survive the winter. And now we're kind of finding out that maybe that's not the case, that, in fact, it's quite the opposite, that it was a very good summer for lemmings and for snowy owl production in the Arctic. They all had lots of chicks in their nest, and so there's many more owls than usual, and they're essentially just spreading out to find some extra space. And just in the past couple of years, we've been attaching GPS satellite tags to snowy owls that show up in the U.S., and it seems like most of them, as far as we can tell, make it and fly back up to the Arctic the following summer.
And that's interesting, because a lot of times it gets covered as the owls are starving and they're getting hit by trucks and they're being harassed by birders with big cameras, and it's not a pretty story, but you're saying maybe it is.
Yeah, I think when we see these eruptions, we should actually see it as a snowy owl success story, because it's been a very good year for them, and just enjoy when they come and hang around us for a while.
So what does that tell us about being human?
Snowy owls, I think, are an example of a bird with wanderlust, because it seems like they can cover thousands of miles with almost no sweat. Like, it takes some energy for them to fly that far. But even in years when it's just an average year and we don't see any in the U.S., in the southern parts of the U.S., snowy owls will fly thousands of miles west and east across the Arctic. And there have been owls that have been tagged in Canada that have gone all the way to Siberia and back. And they seem to be very nomadic. And there are still a few human cultures in the world that are also fairly nomadic in response to the same sort of conditions, people who live in deserts or very harsh, extreme environments like the Arctic. And so snowy owls seem to have this sort of wanderlust that's also present to some degree in people. And there may even be a genetic basis for some wanderlust behavior in people, which could even be related to the first people leaving Africa. So I think that is all very interesting.
That is interesting. And we just got to say, since we're talking about snowies, that once you've seen a snowy owl, you never forget it. They kind of blow you away, don't they?
They're incredible birds. You know, Harry Potter had a pet one, and you look into their eyes, and it's just this piercing yellow color that seems like it's going all the way down to your very soul.
Ah, Yeah, they're awesome. I saw one a winter ago, and they are spectacular birds. Well, we're talking right now with birding expert Noah Stricker, sharing stories of bird behavior and talking about his new book. It's called The Thing with Feathers.
And you can join in the discussion, too. Have you observed some bird behavior that puzzles or fascinates you? Do you find pigeons fascinating? And what is it about birds and bird watching that makes it all so interesting? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us, talk@wpr.org.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell, in for Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the hidden lives of birds with birding expert Noah Stricker, author of The Thing with Feathers.
And you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Have you observed bird behavior that surprised you or puzzled you? Do you have a question about birds in general? You can call at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. And we're going to go to Peter, who's joining us from Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Peter.
Hi, thanks very much for taking my call. I just wanted to tell you that I found a pigeon egg, a fresh pigeon egg on the ground this morning down in Iowa County, Wisconsin. Nothing's growing, nothing's going on, but pigeons are starting to lay eggs already.
Yeah.
Can you comment on that? I'll hang up and listen on my car radio.
All right.
Thanks,
Peter. And Noah, what about that?
Yeah, that's interesting. Pigeons and doves particularly are known for nesting throughout the year. And like other birds, they tend to nest more often in the spring and summer. So I see it might be slightly unusual to find a pigeon egg this early. But pigeons nest in very urban environments. So unlike birds that are out in the forest or field somewhere, which are depending on natural food, which is going to be more abundant in the spring, pigeons can get all the French fries they want year-round, so they may be able to pull off a nest any time of year.
Ah, interesting. And I want to talk about another bird that you cover in your book, the chicken. Now, this is another bird that I guess chicken fanciers are getting more popular, and people like to keep them in the backyard, but they don't seem that remarkable in other ways. But there's some fascinating stuff that you write about. I, for instance, didn't know that chickens outnumbered people 4-1 starting in something like the year 2000. There's a lot of chickens out there.
Yeah, most people don't know this, but chickens, the domestic chicken, are the most abundant vertebrate animal on Earth. There's more than 20 billion chickens in the world, which is more than any other real animal that you can think of.
Now, are those chickens destined for the fryer?
Mostly, yeah.
Mostly.
I think the average lifespan of a domestic chicken is about 6 months.
That's not a long life. So at least they have some interesting things to do, like peck one another. So tell us about that. The chicken pecking order is something that is complex, but it's also fascinating when you look closely at it.
Well, we tend to throw around the words pecking order anytime we start talking about corporate ladders and elementary schools and other social situations, but pecking orders are real and alive in nature and serve a purpose. If you look at a chicken coop, inside the coop you'll have about a dozen chickens usually, and there is a pecking order. There, the most dominant chicken will always be the first one that eats at the food dish, and then the second one gets to eat, and the third, and so on down the line. And if any chicken tries to jump the order, which they all know and they've all worked out, then it will just get viciously pecked until it goes back to its rightful place in line.
So what does that tell us about people? I mean, do we do the same kind of thing?
I think sometimes we do, and just imagine if chickens didn't have a pecking order inside a chicken coop. It would just be a free-for-all for every meal, and things would be a lot less orderly. So it may be that pecking orders serve a certain purpose in the world. But I will hasten to add that, of course, we are able to communicate and interact socially, maybe with a little bit more dignity than chickens do.
I hope, although not always, not all the time. Let's go to a caller from Madison. This is Jean on the line. Hi, Jean.
Hi. I heard the conversation about homing pigeons, and I wish my husband was available. He's raised and raced homing pigeons for over 40 years, off and on. Uh-huh. And I just wanted to make a comment. He talked about 30 miles an hour. My husband finds that the average, he and his flying buddies from the club, they average about 45 miles an hour. And another fact that's really interesting that we find, my husband actually had a bird return home in a day, 600 miles.
600 miles in one day.
600 miles in one way. Yeah, that's amazing.
A long way, and it was unusual. They usually don't. They go down at night when it gets dark. They don't fly, and then many birds will come home the next day. We've had a bird come home a year later.
Wow.
So we've had lots of fun experiences, but I just wanted to share that. They do average 45 miles an hour.
All right. Well, thanks, Jean. The humble pigeon, a lot speedier than maybe we thought. 45 miles an hour is pretty decent for a pigeon.
Yeah, that's pretty fast. You know, most songbirds are 30 or 40 miles per hour, somewhere in that range, and I guess pigeons are a bit faster than I thought.
Excellent. Well, thanks a lot, Jean. And I want to talk a little, let's get away from the domestic birds now, and we're talking chickens. What about parrots? I understand we can learn something about our love of music from parrots.
Yes, you should go to YouTube when you get a chance and type in Snowball the Dancing Cockatoo and see what comes up. There is a video of this cockatoo that just goes at it to the Backstreet Boys. And it's bobbing its head and slamming its feet up and down and shimmying from side to side and just rocking out to this music. And it's funny to watch. It's had like millions of hits, this one video clip. But there was a neuroscientist a few years ago who saw this on YouTube and thought to himself, huh, that's interesting. I've never heard of a bird dancing to a prescribed auditory beat before. And so he decided to do an experiment to see if this snowball could actually time its movements to a synchronized beat. And so he slowed down and sped up that same Backstreet Boys song and then videoed the bird dancing to it at various speeds. And sure enough, more or less, the bird was able to alter its movements and dance in time.
Wow.
Which is pretty interesting because that's never been shown in any other non-human animal before. And this is something that parrots don't really seem to do in the wild.
Because there's no Backstreet Boys in the wild.
There's no Backstreet Boys presumably. Out in the wild. And so it seems to show some kind of cognitive, you know, mental ability to train its movements to an external beat. And that probably has something to do with the brain, and it could even be connected to our ability to dance to a beat. And when you get into that, you're suddenly studying things like why do we have music at all in the first place? And even where does language come from? These things are all very closely related.
Okay, and we've got a link up to Snowballs grooving to the Backstreet Boys on the Central Time Facebook page if we want to look into that. Interesting that the parrots can keep a beat. That's a new one. And I want to ask you, there was a recent discovery, I don't know if you know anything about this, they're calling it the chicken from hell, a big sort of fossil find of an ancient chicken. Do you know about that one?
I have not heard about the chicken from hell, no.
All right. Well, maybe Gene Purcell, who told me about it, made it up. But we'll have to look. We'll have to look online for that one and maybe cover it later. Well, as we run out of time here, I do want to ask you, though, you've seen a lot of species. Do you have a holy grail bird that you really want to see someday?
Yeah, you know, the bird I've always wanted to see in the wild is called the harpy eagle. And these eagles are feet tall. I mean, they come up at least to your waist or higher. And they are intimidating. Their main diet in the rainforest, in the jungle, is monkeys and sloths. So they basically fly around picking off monkeys all day long and eating
them.
Their legs are as big around as your wrist, and their talons, if you spread them out, are as big around as a dinner plate. So they are awesome birds, and they're very rare these days. They need big patches of unbroken, fairly pristine rainforest, and so you have to be pretty lucky to see one.
So that's a harpy eagle.
Yeah, H-A-R-P-Y, and they're an amazing looking bird too. They're black and white. They have this spectacular crest, and they're just huge.
Wow, they sound amazing. And I want to talk about one other aspect before we let you go. Self-awareness is something that's often seen as uniquely human, or close to unique. Anyhow, maybe we're learning more about that. But it is something that, as humans, we tend to look at an animal and we judge about how self-aware it is, and therefore how closely related it is to us. Do birds show signs of self-awareness?
The question is, when an animal looks in a mirror, what does it see? And we tend to spend so much time looking in mirrors ourselves and recognizing our own reflection that we tend to forget quite how unusual that habit is. There's not a lot of mirrors out in nature. And from what we can tell, most animals in the world can't actually recognize their reflection. If you put most birds in front of a mirror, they'll start attacking their reflection or trying to mate with their reflection or walking around the backside of the mirror to look for this other bird. But nevertheless, a couple years ago, there was this group of German researchers that decided to try the mirror test, as it's generally known, on a group of captive magpies. And they pretty much showed that two of these individual Eurasian magpies, which are very intelligent birds, were able to recognize their reflection in a mirror because they put a little speck of paint on the magpie's chin, and when the magpies looked in the mirror, they started scratching their chins like, oh, weird, I have something strange on my face, I better get it off. And so the question then becomes, what does that mean? And we know that as humans, when we're about a year and a half to 2 years old, that's when we start recognizing our own reflections, and that comes with a lot of other emotional characteristics.
And like, so we may have magpies that are at the beginnings of self-awareness. But I'm sorry, we're going to have to leave it there. No, it's been fascinating.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you. That was Noah Stricker, and he's with Birding Magazine. His new book is called The Thing with Feathers.
Noah Ovshinsky joins us for a regular state news roundup.
Noah, welcome back to Central Time.
It's good to be here. Thanks, Veronica.
So a marathon session in the state legislature last night. Let's take a look at some of the things that happened there, and we'll start with chemotherapy drugs. This was a high-profile one that a lot of people were watching. What happened?
Right. So this bill makes chemotherapy drugs in pill form more affordable, and it puts it really more on par with the chemotherapy drugs that are offered through IVs, which are generally cheaper. And as you mentioned, this has gotten a lot of press because it passed the Senate almost unanimously, but for a time it was unclear what the Assembly was going to do with it.
And what happened? This was, I guess it's being billed as a slightly lightened up version of the original bill.
Right. So the Assembly did end up voting on an amended version of the bill. And what it does is it caps copays at $100 per month.
And what happens then?
Well, at this point, I can't say what will happen in the Senate because, again, this is a different version from what the Senate passed. So the Senate has to re-vote on this latest amended version. I can say, though, that there will be a lot of pressure on the Senate to pass this new version of the bill. The Senate meets one more time before they adjourn for the year. And so there'll be quite a bit of pressure. The governor has weighed in on this. The governor said he will sign it. As we just heard, the Assembly weighed in on it with their vote. And advocates for cancer patients have weighed in on this as well. They're also supportive of this amended bill.
There was a little bit of drama surrounding this bill when Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald hit pause on it, and it's moving again, as you just told us. But do we know where Scott Fitzgerald is on the bill?
Right. So the big question now is what's the Senate going to do when they come back into session? And at least according to the AP, Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald is reviewing the amendment. We haven't really gotten a sense of what he thinks of it yet.
So we'll be watching that one. And we'll move on to another area that was under consideration, school accountability. Catch us up there.
Right. So with the school accountability bill, actually the reverse happened. The Assembly scrapped its plan for the bill and ended up voting and approving the Senate's version. So the opposite of what happened with the chemotherapy drug bill. The Assembly bill that they wanted to pass went a bit further than the Senate was willing to go. It imposed sanctions on poor performing schools that received taxpayer money of some kind. So this proposal was criticized by, you know, both supporters of traditional public schools and those that support voucher schools. The Senate bill, which the Assembly ended up voting on, simply requires test results and other kinds of data to be made public. So it doesn't include any sanctions. It's kind of a lighter version of what the Senate was voted on.
And give us a status check on where this one is in the legislature.
Right. So the thing about this accountability bill, as it was passed, minus the sanctions for poor performing schools, what this bill does is it essentially allows parents, teachers, kids, the state at large, to compare the variety of schools that are now available in the state, be it traditional public schools, charter schools, and now voucher schools, which will grow in number in the coming years. So it'll allow people to really compare apples to apples when it comes to performance.
And this bill looks to be on its way to the governor's desk, right?
It is. The bill is on the way to the governor's desk, and he has indicated he will sign it.
All right. So that's another one we'll be keeping our eyes on as it progresses a bit there. And amidst all the bills that did pass, there were some, obviously, that were left on the table. Can you give us a rundown on what didn't get passed?
Right. So there are a few things the Assembly did not vote on, which means they are effectively, dead for the year. Now, these are bills either the Assembly didn't vote on or they didn't make it to the floor for votes in either chamber. One was the cookie bill, which has gotten quite a bit of press. And this bill passed the Senate, but the Assembly didn't do anything with it, didn't schedule a vote. So it's effectively dead. And what this cookie bill would have done is it would have allowed home cooks to sell up to $10,000 worth of baked goods using their home kitchens.
Okay, so this seems like something that a lot of people who want to do small businesses out of their home, sort of a cottage food thing, would have enjoyed.
Right. This is an example of what you just said. It's cottage food legislation, and it's something that many states around the country are embracing. I think somewhere around 40 states or so already have something like this on the books. Wisconsin actually already has a so-called, we'll call it the pickle bill. That's actually already on the books. That was passed, I think, in 2010. And that allows home cooks to sell certain canned items, high acid items like pickles and that sort of thing. So there is a precedent for this. But the cookie bill that dealt with home baked items, just couldn't get through the Assembly.
Yeah, that's interesting. The pickle bill went forward, the cookie bill not so much.
Right. So the Senate actually passed it, but the Assembly didn't even bring it up for a vote. The critics of this bill, one of the reasons why it wasn't brought up even for a vote in the Assembly before they adjourned was there are some folks in the Assembly who feel that this represents it's unfair competition to traditional bakeries who are subject to a larger number of regulations. And that, home bakers should be subject to the same kinds of regulations. They just want these different folks to be treated the same.
And maybe there isn't quite the huge market out there for pickled products that there is for bakers and bakery products, sounds like.
Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of bakers who would like to be able to make this stuff in their homes and sell it as a small business. For now, at least, this bill is dead.
Okay. Well, let's look at another one left on the table, a Fracsan bill.
Right. So this was one that we've covered a lot just in the last few months. And basically what this Fracsan bill, of course, and this is the Fracsan industry here in Wisconsin, which is very big and growing. And basically what this bill said was once a Fracsan company has received a permit to operate, local units of government, be it the county or townships or city or whatever, they would not be able to add new regulations to that frac sand mine once they're permitted. And this whole issue really goes back to this issue of local control, which has been a matter of a lot of debate, for a long time, but certainly recently, about to what extent can townships and local units of government and counties, to what extent can they regulate this huge and growing industry. Tom Tiffany, who is the sponsor of this bill, you know, says the rules shouldn't be changed in the middle of the game. You know, the industry, the frac sand industry, is concerned that governments are passing new ordinances as a way to keep them out. And as it is, there is a patchwork of regulations around the state as far as how these frac sand mines are treated. You know, critics say that this bill was vague and that it could have broader implications. And so it'll be very interesting to see if this is brought back in the next session. I know there's a lot of concern among supporters of the frac sand industry. There's a lot of concern that these local ordinances are becoming too burdensome for these frac sand companies.
And there's a patchwork of different ones across the state.
Exactly. And they range from very loose regulations to very strict regulations. I mean, there are actually some moratoriums right now on new frac sand mines. So there's really it runs the gambit, really.
Well, we'll keep – obviously the frac sand issue is one that will keep evolving in the next year, the next session. So that's certainly something, like you said, we'll be watching to see if it comes back. And another story here, this might come as a surprise to a lot of people. Apparently, the drought in southern Wisconsin has returned.
Yes. This little news item caught me by surprise because I don't know about you, Veronica, but I feel like it's snowed a lot.
Yeah, I think everybody's on board with that assessment. Yeah.
Seems to be a lot of water hanging around. But no, according to the U.S. Drought Monitor, which follows this sort of thing, 44% of Wisconsin is experiencing abnormally dry to moderate drought conditions. Now, this is mainly in the south, central, and western parts of the state.
No, I know you're a newsman. You're not a meteorologist or a
yes.
climatologist.
Yes.
But how is this possible?
I have no idea. I have no idea. But what I can tell you is that these areas that have identified as being experiencing abnormally dry or moderate drought conditions, that they've gotten less than 50% of the normal precipitation that they would expect over the past 3 months.
I suppose we don't know what effect snow melt will do to that figure, but that's really something. 50% less than normal precipitation.
Yeah, it's quite a shortfall.
So I guess we'll all be watching to see what happens next with spring weather.
Yeah, and obviously this could have implications for farmers and really a wide variety of industries and jobs.
Excellent. Well, Noah, thanks a lot for coming by.
It was good to be here. Thanks.
Noah Ovshinsky is WPR's assistant news director.
He joins us every week at this time for a look at what's making news in Wisconsin.